Hey Dan, how's it going?
Hey, I'm on day 10 of quarantine. Other than that, I'm just fine.
Wow, that's quite an
How about yourself?
accomplishment. 10 days of quarantine. So, yeah, welcome everybody to Trickle Down Socialism, where we discuss how the US currently has a system of socialism, except it's for the super rich and corporations, where we also try to defang the term socialism and explore how government, with just a slight tweak in priorities, could be a force for a lot of good in all of our lives.
That sure could happen, Pat, and it kind of seems like it is. As you may know, the federal government has already passed two, they're calling them phases of in response to the coronavirus. And number three, phase three, by far the biggest, is pending a negotiation between both houses and the president, and it's looking to be upwards of $2 trillion. So we're going to talk about that. And more in this week's episode. So stay tuned.
$2 trillion spent on individuals, people, and businesses. The government
It's
helping
unclear.
out. Okay.
It's unclear.
Okay.
So I think that's what the negotiation is about.
Let's dig into that together. So stay tuned, folks.
We'll be right back.
This week's episode is brought to you by Old White Dudes. Old White Dudes, we've been running the world for like 2,000 years. How's that been working out for you? That's right, old white dudes. In a big crisis where the most vulnerable group is old people with pre-existing conditions, why not try old white dudes? Never failed you before.
Hey, Pat.
Hey, Dan, what's going on? So I understand you've been doing a bunch of research. Quarantine has gotten you to dive pretty deeply into the news here. And I understand you've been in particularly obsessed with these stimulus packages that the Congress and the Senate have been putting together. Is that
Well,
true?
that's correct. That's correct, Pat. Some would even say that it's been pretty stimulating for me.
Whoa.
So there, we are the two houses of Congress and the president are currently working on the third stimulus, or as I said before, phase three, which is going to be one of the biggest bills in modern history. The first stimulus, which I think kind of went under the radar because it was right when people were still coming to terms with this being a national crisis, was passed on March 6th. It was $8.3 billion, which in terms of congressional bills is not super big. But importantly, $3 billion of that was allocated for research on vaccines and another $800 million for potential treatments. $2 billion for the CDC. $1 billion for USAID, which is the Agency for International Development, $1 billion for state and local governments, and then $500 million, $500 million for Medicare providers. My question for you, Pat, is in the most recent Trump administration budget, the CDC was cut by 16%, and I'm wondering, the current CDC budget stands at $11 billion, and this was as of the last budget cycle. What do you think would have the impact would have been if this three, two, sorry, $2 billion for the CDC that they've just now allocated had been set aside a year ago?
Yeah, so I think that's a great question. I think we actually have to go back a little bit farther to 2018 first to look at this.
It's actually further, Pat, because far is a distance. So just sorry. Sorry to be like
No,
that.
so I think if you look at it on a timeline, it's farther, far is a distance, further is depth. We're not going into a depth here, but
We
anyway,
probably shouldn't go into depth
you
in
really
this
shouldn't,
dialogue.
you should not go after me on grammar, just so you know. Okay, so in 2018, Trump, as a result of his kind of scorched earth policy of undoing anything that even smelled like Obama had touched it, he slashed the pandemic response team, which Obama had created, as a result of kind of concerns around the Ebola virus and whether that could reach our shores here in North America. So that pandemic response team could have been instrumental in kind of foreseeing this problem, jumping into action as soon as the first word was out of China that there was a novel coronavirus. And kind of jumping into like what can we do right now to get ready for this. But in terms of, you're absolutely right, in terms of like slashing the budget and now trying to just add that money back into the CDC, that's not really the effective way of doing things, right? So the effective way of doing things is to keep public health programs like this well-funded. Mm-hmm. And active all the time, and especially in times when they're not dealing with a crisis, because that's when they can actually do a lot of their work and make a lot of their discoveries. I heard someone, a doctor recently saying that public health is working best when you don't hear anything about public health, right? Mm-hmm. So that's when they're getting things done. That's when they're looking forward to potential epidemics or potential health, you know, threats to public health, and seeing what they can do to combat that. So the best play on CDC is to keep them well-funded, keep them working, and just to listen to their guidance whenever they have guidance for us.
Follow up about the pandemic response team. Any sense of, because now the whole conversation is about protective medical equipment, which seems to be in high demand across many communities, but particularly New York and Washington State, and probably soon California as well. Any sense of if the pandemic response team would have had involvement in procuring larger stockpiles? Because it seems the dialogue that I've been hearing in the media is about, you know, a breathing machine, a respirator is not something you can just make overnight, because it is a pretty complicated device.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
You can't just you can't make 10,000 a day, right? It's not a widget.
Right.
But would a pandemic response team have been involved in ramping those up, say a year ago, if they were around?
Yeah. I mean, they would be thinking about basically just forward planning and thinking about, okay, what happens if a pandemic hits us in the next 3 months? Are we ready? And they'd also have to think through the contingencies of what types of pandemics would hit, right? So their job wouldn't be only in thinking about a coronavirus, which is, you know, going to hit the lungs and going to require ventilators in order to treat that virus. They would be thinking about all kinds of other problems. So I think, you know, part of what they were doing was making sure that we had national stockpiles of that personal protective equipment and of, you know, medical equipment that we would need in the event of a pandemic. And I think that, you know, there was a tendency to look at that as dead weight that could be cut in order to pay for things like a border wall or other things that seemed like high priority items at the time. But right now we're seeing that the price that we're paying for kind of defunding or even disbanding a group like the pandemic response team.
That's right. And I think one really not small, I was about to say a small example, but one really salient example. I was listening to Bill de Blasio, mayor of New York, this morning, talking about their surge in need. They have now over 15,000 cases, and that's with essentially a stay-at-home order. I think there's probably some stores that are still open, but for the most part, you know, you've got 9 million New Yorkers staying home. They're at 50,000 cases, 60 deaths, and I read 5% of the global cases.
So yeah,
if New York was a country, so to speak, they would be constituting 5% of the world. And he said they are 10 days from being without equipment, proper medical equipment, and beds. I don't hear a lot of conversation about beds, but I would consider that to be one of the most important pieces of equipment, right? Because you can't have a person sitting on the floor getting medical attention. But that I don't know for sure, but I believe that number 10 days is assuming a predictable increase in cases. Let's say New York were to triple or quadruple. Yeah. That could be 5 days, right?
Right. Right.
And so where are we at then? You know, are we bringing in, let's say, the Midwest, right? Places that you haven't heard of a lot of cases, Tennessee, or just hypothetically, right? You know, these these places that clearly have medical professionals, do you send them in the same way that you send people in a hurricane response or in a another natural disaster? Do you call them? And also, what about the military? What about the trained medical personnel who build literally in combat zones in third world countries, build entire hospital structures? Where are they in this?
Right. Well, and I think this is something like contingency planning for this type of event is exactly what that pandemic response team would have done, right? And I think if we had a more organized response from our executive branch, we would be seeing plans like this being rolled out. Like, if this part of the country comes down and gets hit harder, then where do we find medical personnel to shift over into that region? And I think, you know, and I think in a country where you had a little bit more control ceded to your, you know, if you had a Medicare for all or some type of universal healthcare system, you're going to have doctors who are kind of able to be shifted in that way, and doctors who work for the system as a whole, as opposed to doctors
right.
who are either employed for themselves or work for a specific medical group.
Pat, I need you to slow down. What you're saying sounds a lot like socialism.
I know.
So I just want to be careful on that. Can we move on to the second phase, the second bill?
Yeah.
It was $100 billion passed on March 18th, and the big takeaway for me on this one was the paid sick leave and the coronavirus coverage. I put that in quotes because I'm not so convinced that it is actual coverage. So the paid sick leave was for 2 weeks for all businesses that exceed 500 employees, a 12-week medical leave for people who are taking care of loved ones, basically FMLA. I don't know how.
So wait, let's back it up. You said paid sick leave for businesses that exceed 500. It's paid sick leave for 2 weeks for all businesses that have fewer than 500 employees.
That's correct, with one provision, and this is kind of vague. They wrote in a provision for small businesses. If it constitutes a hardship, then they may not have to pay it. So I don't know what a hardship is. That might be addressed in the third bill, which is coming, because it sounds like the they're passing these laws, and the assumption is still that the employer will cover everyone's unemployment versus the government stepping in. But I think the piece you were asking about was the 500 or more in a country with, you know, thousands of major corporations. Why would there be? What's the need of that provision in an emergency response bill?
Right. Again, that one still feels very much to me like the owners and stockholders of those companies are the ones who are most likely to have the ear of politicians as they're writing this bill. And they're saying, hey, you know, we don't want our workforce to go home en masse. We don't want to we don't want to be on the hook for this. Like, is there anything that you can do as you're writing this bill to kind of keep us protected and keep us as productive as a company as possible, and all these things that they would be worried about? And they are, you know, kind of really the power brokers in a society where we have unlimited campaign contributions allowed, dark money allowed in politics, super PACs, all of those things. That really makes the owners of those giant companies and the stockholders of those giant companies really the true power brokers in our society.
Sounds a lot like corporate socialism.
Yeah, like a special set of rules for the very top, and one that makes sure that they are always taken care of.
So, quick follow up, because I know you're really interested in healthcare and the implications of ideas like Medicare for All on how our country responds to everyday medical needs, but also in situations like this. So the bill has a provision, this second phase bill, for free testing for coronavirus. And President Trump also said he said during a press conference that co-pays and would be waived. And I'm wondering if you think it's realistic that This bill really does cover the response to coronavirus, or are we saying, you know, you can come in and we'll tell you whether or not you have it, right? But do we expect that if 5, 10, 20 million Americans get the coronavirus, that these coronavirus victims, and I would call them victims because these are not lifestyle choices that are bringing this upon them.
Yeah.
Are these folks really going to get a bill for $0, or are they going to get, potentially bankrupt from this, despite there being a bill that supposedly covers coronavirus?
Yeah, I think everything I've seen so far says that they've only come up with an agreement for full coverage on the testing for coronavirus. So I don't think that we are in a place where we have health insurance companies saying, yeah, by all means, we'll cover the bill. That can become quite exorbitant quite quickly. Just any time spent on that respirator is super expensive. You know, any time spent in the hospital with the full care of nurses and staff there is super expensive. And we would see people ending up, or we're going to see people ending up with huge bills as a result of the treatment that they need to undergo once they get that positive test, especially if they start to show those super right. severe symptoms that a segment of the population is showing.
So that's what I feel like the debate is missing, Pat. If you go on any news show right now, or Twitter or Facebook, wherever the conversation is happening for you, I'm noticing that the focus is a lot on, you know, where's the gear, right? Where's the equipment that we need, medical professionals need, and also about the checks, right? So is every American going to get 1,000? Is it going to be 1,500? Is it going to be means tested? I heard someone say today, is Bill Gates really going to get a check? And I think that kind of misses the point, because let's say a year from now, 18 months from now, we've gotten this somewhat under control and people have some debt. Right. And, you know, maybe the checks weren't big enough, or some people got laid off.
Yeah.
If we have hundreds of thousands of Americans with a bill of $100,000 to $300,000, which a 2 week hospital stay in intensive care could certainly earn you.
Sure.
To me, that's a much bigger impact than, hey, did we max out our credit cards, or did we, you know, default on a student loan?
Right.
I think we're missing Americans. Really, we get very easily distracted.
Sure.
I think the conversation is like, hey, am I going to get, you know, 1,000 or 1,500? I think that kind of misses the bigger point here.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have heard a few politicians talking about it. One in particular has been talking about it almost daily, despite the fact that he is almost surely does not have a chance at winning the Democratic nomination for the presidency. He's still using the media attention he still has, and that is Bernie Sanders. And, you know,
mm-hmm.
might have once or twice used the term socialism or socialist to describe himself, always connecting it with that word that seems to soften the blow of democratic socialism. But still, he's speaking out just any chance he gets about the fact that we need to cover treatment of this illness. Otherwise, you have people who will stay home. And try to brave it out. Maybe they'll go the step of quarantining themselves, which is great in terms of spreading the illness, but they're not getting the treatment they need, and they're putting themselves at risk. Because what I've heard is, and what I've read pretty extensively, is that the coronavirus, once it starts to really get severe symptoms, those severe symptoms turn into a lot of difficulty breathing very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
if you're trying to wait it out at home and, you know, maybe just like spend that time at home just praying that you aren't going to end up having to go into the hospital and incur those costs, you're putting yourself at risk of having those symptoms develop and compound and get a lot worse very quickly. So you're putting yourself
at risk. Yeah, so I think what you're saying is a lot of folks might, as they have been for years, by the way, uninsured Americans tend to go for hospital visits at a much or regular checkups, for that matter, at a much lower rate.
Sure. Even underinsured people who know that they don't have a lot of help paying whatever bill they incur when they get there.
So they may find out, similar to somebody who waits too long to get a cancer diagnosis or something.
Sure.
They may show up at the ER with 24 hours to live. And that just might be way too late for them.
Right.
So we want folks to be seeking medical attention at a time when our medical system, or I should say our healthcare system, is broken.
Yeah.
Hey, Pat, I'm getting a word from our sponsor that we need to step away. But when we come back, we're going to talk about the third and most certainly the most, the biggest phase of this coronavirus response.
So just to fill us in a little bit before we step away for that commercial break that is so badly needed by our very real sponsors.
Yeah, they're real. I spoke to them in my head a few minutes ago. Good. Continue. Good.
So the question is, you keep using the word big or small to talk about these stimulus packages.
I actually said bigly, Pat. That's a word.
No. You know what? He never said that, but we'll get into that some other time. Here,
jeez, come on.
He said big league, and that's the only time you'll hear me defend him on this podcast. But when you say big, what are you talking about? You talking about the number of senators who sign on to it? Or
no, so it's originally, let's say midweek last week, it was supposed to be $1 trillion. So yeah. That's
okay. So you're talking about money. It's the biggest
money, but it's also comprehensive. So what I've heard is, it's going to include cash payments to Americans.
Yeah.
It's most likely, because this is a negotiation, it's going to include the airline industry and other.
Let's save all this, these important details for after the break. Let's go ahead to that break.
That's why I was trying to go to the break, Pat.
Yeah. No, that makes sense.
All right. Bye, Pat.
Yeah. Later.
Bye-bye.
So we're ready to start talking about phase three of this economic stimulus that our government's putting together?
Yes, sir.
Great.
Yeah, so it seems like this is the trickiest of the three by far, because at the beginning, the first phase, you know, getting more money to state and local hospitals or getting testing and potential treatments going, that seems pretty non-controversial. Now we're getting to a point where special interests are getting involved. So we're looking at, from what I've read, anything from $1,000 to $2,000 per American, depending on income. So there would be an income threshold somewhere between $75,000 and $100,000 a year, where it would be cut off. In other words, it would be means tested. People with higher incomes would not get it. So that's been a big sticking point, because I've read that also that folks who, if you're using the tax system, folks who, as it was originally written, folks who don't pay taxes or who have minimal tax bills were set to get only about $600 each, which means that those Americans who most need it might not be receiving it.
Right.
And then there's this big question of what is unemployment? What does it mean to get paid as an unemployed worker? Because clearly someone who's at a full-time salaried 9-to-5 job, that is the textbook definition of unemployed. But Pat, what are your thoughts? What happens to self-employed Americans, members of the gig economy, who get paid based on the daily performance of a job, which they're not allowed to do, or folks like in the restaurant or tourism industries who could potentially be out of work for 6 to 12 months, depending on how long this goes on. How do they factor into this definition of unemployed?
Well, I think this is what a lot of the holdup is that there's some disagreement among Republicans and Democrats. Democrats want to loosen the definition and kind of all of the requirements put in place for people to receive unemployment. And the goal with that is to not only provide a one-time payment, but also to allow people to kind of collect enough money to get by for the foreseeable future, where the next few months, where people are going to be, you know, really strapped for cash if their businesses are still shut down, if people are still not getting into Ubers, for instance. So I think Democrats are pushing for some type of change in the rules of unemployment, but I have real doubts about that getting done for our gig economy workers, or anyone else who would be left out of the traditional definition of unemployment.
Yep, that's definitely a concern, and I also wonder about big industries, namely the travel industry, which clearly has been hard hit. Flights have been cut by 90%, in many parts, certainly internationally, but even domestically.
Yeah.
And then arguably, the Fed has already pumped $1.5 trillion into the economy. Not necessarily a bailout, but putting new money into the markets to keep the money flowing or the wheels greased, so to speak. But I wonder what you think the influence of corporate socialism might be on the final bill, which, by the way, has gone from $1 trillion earlier in the week to $2 trillion. How much of that doubling in an already large spending bill is the influence of corporate socialism?
Yeah, I think we are going to be looking at a lot of help going to companies in the airline industry, but I think you're going to see a lot of other industries get lumped in there. Now, what's interesting is it's not just the travel and airline industries, it's also the hospitality industries that have mm-hmm. originally floated as being the group to get that first bailout. Now, do you happen to know what Trump's business specializes in?
I believe there's some hotels involved.
Some hotels, right? So yeah, there were,
I remember vaguely buying some Trump steaks and some Trump wine.
No, those have gone, long since gone under. But
well, that's why they tasted so bad, because I think that they had been expired.
The main
I bought steak. Them at a steep discount. I'm a notorious short seller of defunct businesses, Pat.
Glad you got them on the cheap. But hotels, and so I think some of the willingness from the White House to jump in and help that industry is coming from someone in that White House's personal, involvement in that industry. But it's not just those industries, right? And I think you're going to see corporate socialism rear its head when we get to look at what specifically is in this bill. Because you mentioned the cost of that one-time check going out to individuals at somewhere around $250 billion. So if you're at $2 trillion already, where else is this money going? Right. And so we saw this early on in 2008, actually before George W. Bush even left the White House, he put together a bank bailout, the TARP package, which was designed to save those banks from failing. And I think this is what you see in a country that subscribes to corporate socialism, is that the number one thing is, let's make sure that the big giant corporations don't ever fail. They're too big to fail. Right.
Right. So
the implications on your economy.
When they're job creators, right?
Right. Very high quality jobs. But once you get to a point where you have these giant corporations that have so much of a foothold in your national economy, the risk of losing one of those companies is just too great, and that's right. So the belief there is, let's help those companies first, because they are holding up our stock market and they're holding up our federal or our national economy here.
Now, in fairness, to look at the other side, to look at both sides, I have heard the argument from some Democrats that anyone unemployed should just get covered and we'll pay them from the federal rules, right? And the argument on the other side, a conservative argument, would be that if you fund them federally or on the state level without sort of going through the corporations or the small businesses, right, themselves, they have no incentive to keep people on the payroll, right? Because those people are now just, they're fine. Now I can cut that whole line item or 50% of it, right? So the other argument is, if you funnel unemployment through the payroll system, right, then you may in fact provide an incentive in a way to keep people on, because essentially you're saying, federal government is saying, hey, we're going to pay half of your workers' salaries for a period of time.
Yeah, but I don't think that's ever the real calculus that's going on in a company's, you know, in a boardroom when deciding on layoffs. They don't often think first, oh, if we cut these people from our payroll, are they going to get federal unemployment without fighting too much for those benefits?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think, yes, in your mind or in my mind or someone who's thinking about that average worker.
Pat, I wouldn't advise that you don't try to get inside my mind.
Yeah.
It's a scary place.
Based on what comes out of your mouth, I can imagine it's pretty scary.
That's true. You should hear what doesn't come out.
Oh, dear. But I don't think that's the real, they're not talking about what's going to happen to each of these workers when we fire them. They're talking about what is this going to do to our stock price? Mm-hmm. How is this going to be perceived, by the country and by customers? That's their main calculus during those types of talks.
So this bill has not passed yet. What do you say we come back in a couple days and we recap once it is passed, and any closing thoughts as we, you know, sort of enter this next round of negotiations and really an unknown crisis, both medically and financially for Americans.
So I did want to bring up something last episode in our pilot. In our pilot episode, I mentioned the fact that we had over 100 hospitals over the last 10 years that had closed due to bankruptcy.
A lot of them rural hospitals, right?
Right. Yeah. So I wanted to bring up the fact that we actually had, it was announced earlier today that two hospitals that had faced just such bankruptcy are now under contract to open as provisional hospitals to aid in the treatment of COVID-19 patients. So they're both in California. One is St. Anthony's Hospital in East L.A., so it was no longer profitable because a lot of East L.A. is the poorer section of town. So you wouldn't have as many
Medicaid money.
Right. You wouldn't have as many customers or patients, being able to pay for their treatment as often. And then there's another hospital as well that the name of it is escaping me at the time. But this is going back to my essential point about how this would be different if we had a Medicare for all system. Those hospitals would not have been shuttered in the first place because they're serving a group of people who really need that treatment. It just so happens that they can't pay for their treatment at the same, the same as people with expensive insurance can pay for it, or who have money to pay out of pocket for those types of expenses.
I'm glad you brought that up.
So one last thing on this is that you're now going to see those hospitals jump back in action, but what is it going to take to get them going again? Right. So you got to get new equipment in there. You got to get it cleaned out and sterilized. You got a bunch of stuff that needs to happen.
You might need some mask leaders.
Right, ventilators.
I've heard those are protective
equipment, but you're gonna now shave all this money that could have gone into just making those hospitals more effective, into just getting them off, getting them out of the mothballs and running again. And so it speaks again to the fact that our system, as it currently is constructed, is less efficient than a single payer system that would have some type of central planning involved.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because, as you know, I'm from a rural state. And I think right now, if you turn on the news, New York City is in crisis. I think soon, I hope not, but I think California being on a statewide, stay at home order, they have many major cities. So right now, the focus is on urban America. But when it inevitably moves to rural America, if you think that cities like New York lack capacity, wait till you get to the counties that have one hospital for 100 square miles or something like that.
Right.
I think that's when it's going to get really bad because, frankly, you can't just ramp up or you can't ask people to work overtime if they don't work there anymore. Right. You can't just do a double shift if there is no hospital.
Right. Exactly.
So to be continued, Pat. Thanks for the time, everyone who tuned in. Thanks for listening. And we will see you again in a couple days for the next episode of
Trickle Down Socialism.
That's right. See you next time.